Hey everybody, Coach Jonathan here with a quick update before we dive into today's special episode. It was recorded off-site at Kona, and as a result, you'll notice that the audio sounds a bit different, but hopefully it shouldn't cause any issues for y'all. The other update that I wanted to give you is, of course, that coming up very soon, that's going to be Saturday, November 4th, we have a live podcast recording. You can join us live in person, ask your questions, but most importantly, we're going to be interviewing Matt Fitzgerald, the endurance sports writer. He wrote a book called How Bad Do You Want It that we've talked about a ton on the podcast, and that's what we're going to get into, the psychology of performance. So how to use your mind to get more out of your body when you train. So you can join us for that in San Francisco, California. That's going to be at the Rafa Cycle Club in San Francisco. And we're even going to do a group ride thereafter, go up and climb Mount Tam, weather pending, and explore a bit of Marin County. It's going to be a no-drop ride. It's going to be awesome. We're going to have some food for y'all, some drinks. They have a cafe right there. Awesome location. Awesome guest. Matt Fitzgerald should be able to provide a huge amount of insight. So please join us. That's Saturday, November 4th at the Rafa Cycle Club in San Francisco. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Zimmerman.
Hi, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hey, hey.
And a very special guest today, Andrew Talansky. How's it going, man?
It's going well. Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Where are we right now, actually?
We are a couple miles down Ali Drive, sitting right by the water in beautiful Kona, Hawaii.
Yeah.
You have a very much better rental house than us.
We have a lot.
We got lucky. It was we were looking last minute for a place here, and all of a sudden this popped up. Somebody, I think, who had been planning to come to Ironman canceled. And it was free this week, so.
Shoot,
man. Wow. Took it. I think we'll be taking it next year, too.
It's so an awesome place.
Why is, you're a cyclist, very famous American cyclist.
Can we cover that really quick? Yeah. Sorry, before we jump in, and I don't want to make you blush or anything, Andrew, but national time trial champion. You've won the Critérium du Dauphiné. You've been top 10 at the Tour twice, once?
10th and 11th, so yeah, only one time.
Okay.
We'll call it top 11th and top 10th.
Yeah, there we are.
Nobody cares about 11th. Yeah.
And then a whole bunch of other accolades. This year, your win at the Tour of California on stage, what was it, five? Stage four?
Yeah, Mount Baldy.
One of the better races I've seen in years. It was awesome. And you're known as the Pit Bull. That's the nickname they've given you because of your tenacity, right?
Yeah.
So, anyways, and you've ridden for Cannondale for the majority of your pro career.
Yes.
Is that, I think, all of it? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I turned pro in 2011 with, you know, it was then Garmin Cervelo, but it's been the Slipstream Sports organization, Jonathan Vodders from the beginning. Had different names during that time, but at its core, it's been Slipstream Sports my whole seven-year pro career.
And you've been at this from before U23 stuff all the way back to, what, 17 years old, roughly?
17 years old. So, yeah, 11-ish years ago to when I first got on the road bike.
And so going back to Nate's question, then what the heck are we doing in Kona?
Yeah.
Well, we're here because this year I've decided to leave the world of professional cycling behind and try my hand in the world of triathlon and specifically Ironman. So I'm here in Kona with a few of the great sponsors I have, like Cliff Bar, and you know, the main goal is to take in as much of the race as possible, to absorb it, to see it, to learn about it, to speak with the, you know, incredibly experienced athletes who are here, and to take it all in.
So yeah. My first question is, why? You're at like the top level of cycling. Why abandon that and go into a whole nother sport?
I mean, that's the question, right? That's kind of the question I like getting, is not necessarily, oh, what do you want to do or what do you want to achieve? It's the why. And that's the driving reason, because all those other things are a bit of an unknown, but the why is a very tangible thing for me. And there's really three aspects to it. You know, first and foremost, honestly, there's the family side. I have a 7-month-old son. Professional cycling, just as professional triathlon, obviously, is it's a very demanding sport, but in pro cycling, you're gone racing 80 days a year.
Oh, geez.
That's not counting
travel. So those
are
race days?
Yeah, race days. I mean, if you look, there are guys who race 90 to 100 days a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Some, you know, so anywhere in that literally 60 to 100 range is the standard number of race days. You know, you have 3 weeks at a time, which was really basically a month of your life with every grand tour you do. And you know, there's also the risk factor. As I've gotten older, I've not enjoyed the what appears to me, and guys who retired from the sport already or who came into it maybe 10 years ago have kind of validated that. It just seems like it's gotten a little bit more and more dangerous. There's you know, maybe not a lot of respect in the peloton, and people are willing to take a lot of risks. And that's one thing when you watch Vincenzo Nibali fly down a descent, he's choosing those risks himself and he's an extremely skilled rider. But it's another thing when you're 150 people and, you know, your fate is really at the hands of not only yourself, but just everybody around you. And that's, you know, I watch friends like Pete Stetna have crashes that were completely avoidable due to lack of safety on the organizer's side, you know, a steel pole in the final 100 meters of a Pays Vasco. I've watched guys have accidents that have put them in comas, like at the Vuelta a couple years ago, and you see those, and then you continue on with your racing as if that's what is
you just kind of. How'd you do that? Like you know
that's the thing. Eventually, it got harder and harder for me because that's not a normal human reaction to seeing somebody broken or, you know, in something that's a life-altering injury on the side of the road. If you saw that in a normal setting, it affects you, right? Mm-hmm. And pro cycling maybe encourages you to block that out and continue with what you're doing. And at the end of the day, the bike race is not nearly as important as, you know, people have died in the last couple of years from, you know, from incidents in races, whether be it with a motorcycle or just a crash. And those risks weigh on me. And you have those risks riding on the road every day. But in my mind, that's more life. I mean, there are terrible things like Michele Scarponi this year that also weigh on you. He left, you know, two kids behind, and he was just out on a training ride on roads he's ridden every day. So things happen in life, absolutely. But I came to enjoy, I never enjoyed the risk, but I came to just kind of fully recognize that more and more. So I didn't enjoy that side. I didn't enjoy being gone from my family as much as I was. You know, I left 10 days after my son was born for a month, and then I left for another 2 months in June and July. And I just said, I'm not willing to do this. That was a long answer, but that was one part. Part two, honestly, the business side. In cycling, you sign a contract with a team. The team handles all relationships, right? Whether it doesn't matter if it's your clothing, your bikes, your equipment. You sign with a team and they manage all that, which in some ways is great because things are dialed in and taken care of. But in other ways, it's not great because it distances you a bit from the people you're working with. In moving into triathlon, you build all those relationships yourself. I've sat down face to face with every person who's backing me on this and I'm working with, and you're building real lasting relationships. And most importantly, real lasting relationships with companies and people and brands that share my values in life and also in business. And it's been a very fun process. I enjoy engaging with the people. I enjoy creating something meaningful and ideally long lasting.
Yeah.
So that's a big opportunity. You know, there are brands like Cliff Bar that I wanted to work with for the last 7 years, and it hasn't always been possible within pro cycling. And moving into this, I have the opportunity to work with the best bike brand in the world, Canyon. I have the opportunity to work with, you know, the people who've changed the whole kind of nutrition, not just for cycling, but just all athletic endeavors, Cliff Bar. I have people like that, in addition to others that I get to work with. And, you know, the last side is, which is equally as important, is the athletic side. You know, somebody, Gary Erickson, actually put this really well to me. He said, you know, this is like Cliff Bar. Like, this is a leap of passion, not logic. Right. Logic dictates you stay in pro cycling for 7 more years or so. You retire when you're mid-30s and, you know, you enjoy that and take it for what it is. Passion wasn't there for that anymore for the reasons I just kind of described. And Ironman has always captured my imagination because of just the grueling nature of it. Not just Kona, but all the Ironman events. And Kona specifically just seems like one of the most grueling given the conditions, the competition. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the history of some of the rivalries in the sport, how it started, it's always captured my imagination, as well as the individual aspect of it, that you are just out there. And ultimately, it's down, everybody trains hard, to your ability to suffer and to keep it together on the mental end for over 8 hours of racing. So this is, you know, this is a new adventure and a new challenge, just like getting to the Tour de France when I started riding when I was 17 was a huge motivation. The opportunity to take on a new challenge at 28 years old and try to, you know, work as hard as I can to be successful in a brand new sport that I'm very motivated by and very passionate about. It's a great challenge, and I'm thankful for the opportunity. And
it's pretty, like, I think that just looking at how many cyclists have, like, made that move, yep, and come over like that, they're kind of all over the map. But especially when we look at, you know, the most prominent one was Lance moving over. And talk about, I mean, two very different athletes in terms of body build and everything else. I think that this is something that you moving over from cycling to triathlon is something that hopefully a lot of people can get interested in and excited about, because I think there's a legit chance here.
But the big thing too, other cyclists have done it, but they always do it when they're old, right? Yep. They retire, mm-hmm, and they're like Lance, 38, and I think it was 38 when he came over, and he's like, hey, I'm gonna just, like, everyone on the forums is like, Lance is just gonna smoke everybody, and he didn't. But you're 28. We talked to Craig Alexander last night, and he said that you've got 10 years in you to race Kona.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly the way I see it. I mean, I felt when we kind of weighed the possibilities and decided, I say we, my family, my friends, the people who are backing me with this, weighed the possibility of doing this, I mean, that was a big consideration. You know, the moment to do it was now. It's not a year. It's not 3 years from now. The moment was now, because, you know, the level that this sport is at and has been taken to, not just on the bike, but in the run and the swim, I mean, it's incredible. You have Olympic gold medalists like Jan Frodeno coming with that sort of speed, and just they've changed the game, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's no secret. I mean, just like with cycling, there's no replacement for the time in the pool, the time swimming, and the time running, and especially the running side, making sure you have the runway to do it properly, to, you know, ideally avoid injury, to build up slowly. And that's what the goal is. I mean, I don't expect to come, you know, the goal is to qualify, obviously, for Kona in 2018 and to be here to get that experience. Definitely can't put a results goal on it at the moment. But, you know, I see it initially as a bit of a 3-year project to see. I think by that time that will have given me enough runway. So I think, you know, by Kona in 2020 will be the kind of real glimpse of what my, you know, capabilities in the sport might be. And I'll be 31. You know, when I race that.
Wow. Everyone wants to know, you swam as a kid a little bit?
I did. I swam in middle school, and I think it was into my freshman year in high school. Yeah, spent some.
How fast were you?
Not exceptionally. Like, there's no, you know, people ask me that, and it's an interesting thing, because it's kind of fun to revisit these things that I was never the best at, you know. And when you look at pictures of me when I was younger, I wasn't one of these kids who was, like, fully developed. Even if you look at pictures of me when I started cycling, you know, you have a little kind of puppy fat still. You're just, mm-hmm, your body's not ready to handle the loads. It's how I got hurt running. You know, I've always had motivation to train, but your body wasn't ready for it. And now it's kind of interesting, because what I've done in cycling, the amount of grand tours, the stress it's been put under, I think has changed the engine in a way that, yes, honestly, no amount of training could ever replicate, because you can't replicate a grand tour.
Totally.
And the mindset, you know, my ability for suffering has definitely been expanded. You know, that said, I tell people that comes from my days running cross country, because I was nowhere near the best 5K runner. I mean, if you look at cycling, it's very similar. Things that are 15, 18 minutes, it's too short for me. I need longer. I need 40 minutes. I need an hour time trial. And in running, so running was just suffering for me. I would start and you're suffering immediately and you just suffer the whole time. And I've almost, you know, a bike, you can just, you're not having to move your body. You can collapse on the handlebars, right? You can just be completely blind with pain. But running, you have to keep moving forward. And that taught me to suffer, honestly.
Yeah, and so you did cross country through high school, is that right?
Till my junior year. Yeah, I believe my junior year was the last year I ran. And then I was just training a ton for the next year. I had, you know, fully bought into kind of building your aerobic base and doing that. And I just...
On the bike.
Well, no, on running. Running. And then I got injured. Mm. And I started riding the doctor told me I could do that. You know, I got a stress fracture in my shin because I just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And in hindsight, my body doesn't look anything like it does now. And I shouldn't have been doing that, but nobody tells you any differently. So I got hurt, started riding, and you know, went down that path.
So what are you going to do now let's go through the sports. First, swimming. What are you going to do to become a top level triathlete swim?
I mean, that's, you know, what you just said, that's the challenge. And that's kind of the unknown, because I can't sit here and tell you, I can sit here and tell you that physiologically the engine's there. That's there. There's that's a fact. The on paper the requirements are possible, that's on paper, because the speeds these guys are swimming in the front pack, and even the guys who are, you know, ahead of that, and even the second pack within the, you know, pro field, it's been taken up. I mean, you have to be an exceptional swimmer to come out of the water even near the front. Mm-hmm. So, you know, honestly, it's just going to be a lot of work. I mean, there's no replacement for the volume, for having that kind of base to be able to swim, you know, depending on the range, hopefully faster, obviously faster than an hour, but in the, you know, 50 minutes, 55 minutes, 56 minutes at your maximum ability for that amount of time. There's muscular endurance you need, just like, much like cycling. Mm-hmm. So there's no replacement for the time doing it, but, you know, to your question, it's all an unknown. I mean, I can tell you, I met somebody who I may be working with for coaching at the pool today. I actually got to check out the community pool where everybody goes, yeah, which incidentally is an incredible facility, and I wish there was something like that where I live.
So you're going to have a specific swim coach?
No, it'll be somebody who, for the whole sport, you know, because one thing that's been reiterated to me by people with a lot of experience is that you cannot view this as, okay, how do I become the best swimmer and bike, you know, cyclist and runner? It's really, it's one, you know, and that might mean sacrificing some cycling ability to improve the others and get to a competitive level, but it's how do you fit the three together the best? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to just be, okay, I'm a great cyclist. I want to improve the other two disciplines to a competitive level.
That's good to hear, because I think I've heard other cyclists too come say, I just want to get the bike split record, right? And then walk the marathon. That's not cool.
Or they DNF. I mean, it's common, and we see that, like, at Ironman Arizona every year, you know, there's usually a guy that ends up going to that one because it's pan flat.
Smash the bike, and then that's it.
And hoping to make it happen, and yeah, so that's really good to hear.
Yeah, I mean, that's not my goal at all. I can tell you that. Yeah. And my goal is to put together the best Ironman race possible in any event I line up at, a half Ironman, a full distance, a Kona World Championships. The goal is to do the best race possible. And that might not see me have the fastest bike split, because that might not be possible. You have guys like Sebastian Kienle in here. You have some incredible people who then also back it up on the run, who are, you know, racing for the podium or the win here. And you can't discount that. The speeds these guys are going on the bike, it's by no means granted that, you know, that I would be the fastest cyclist there. I mean, I hope to be competitive, but I don't expect to, you know, I think it'll take work to
you're
be
very
near
humble.
The front.
Yeah. And I'm guessing you're going to start with smaller, shorter distances?
There'll be a few just for experience sake, but really pretty much be diving into the halves and the full distance. Part of that is because even the halves, I think, will push my limits as far as pure speed goes, because you have these guys coming from, you know, Olympic medalists like Javier Gomez, like he just did really well. Ben Canute, I think, put in an incredible ride in
Chattanooga,
and Javier just ran him down. And you have guys who are taking it up to a level it's almost just expanding on the Olympic distance, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it'll ever fully maybe occur that way when you switch a race to 8 hours, because there's a huge difference between 4 hours and 8 hours. There's just, it's a monumental shift, and some guys can put that together, some guys can't. I think for me, it'll be a little reversed in that I think those longer distances, the full, when you get over 8 hours, will be maybe more in my wheelhouse, and the shorter ones are what are going to really push me. As far as the speed required.
So do you have any events that you're eyeballing for next year?
That's to be determined.
Yeah.
Obviously the goal is to qualify for Kona. That's an important goal for me personally. This is the biggest race in the world, biggest platform. The course, the conditions honestly motivate me a lot. I grew up in Miami, Florida, and I've always loved the heat, humidity. That's kind of been my, in my wheelhouse. I always loved the Vuelta a España, kind of for that reason. I've performed well in the cold. I'm not a huge fan of racing in the snow and rain and cold, which is sometimes you have to, and that's fine. But the elements here appeal to me. But no, I want to put together a goal, a plan to get here in 2018. But in addition to that, you know, even if I qualified with, in a pipe dream, just three races, I would want to race more. I love racing. That's that's at the end of my competitor. And you have events like maybe Wildflower in California, you have Escape from Alcatraz, you have some kind of cool events that might not be Kona qualifying races, but that I would like to look at doing. And I name those because I know those, I've heard of them and checked them out. But
yeah,
I think there's a laundry list of events like that, that I, you know, would look at incorporating into the schedule.
So on the bike, what differences are you going to do for your bike setup based on like a, you know, like a 40K TT or less that you're probably used to 112 mile TT?
You know, obviously, I mean, position is the key thing. Ironically, I'll probably be able to achieve a faster position that's more comfortable now, given the lack of UCI rules, given the ability I have to play around with equipment and setups now.
Well, what, so what, can you be more specific? Like, what would you change?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the for me, that's always been a bit of like my ace up the sleeve in time trials. It's not the pure power I put out like somebody like Bradley Wiggins or Rohan Dennis or Taylor Finney. It's a lot more the aerodynamics of it and just being able to fold myself into a little ball and honestly the ability to hold that position over long periods of time.
And you're a small guy, to, relatively speaking, to especially a lot of these triathletes.
Yeah, 5'8", 5'9", not so super tall.
You don't have a large frontal area. Even though those guys are aero, you know, you have a smaller frontal area.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, when you're 6 feet tall, no matter what you do, your aerodynamics are not going to be the same as somebody who's a bit smaller. I mean, that's just surface area, space for wind to hit. But there's a lot of things I learned within pro cycling about the best positions for myself. And obviously we'll do testing. We'll go through all those kind of necessary tests and everything to make sure I have the best position with Canyon. But there's not a whole lot. I mean, I think I'll take what I learned in cycling and apply it as far as maybe how you race a certain event, how you use the power over different parts of the course. Obviously, for 112 miles, you can't have the most radical position. That's maybe the fastest. Maybe you're going to have to sacrifice a little bit for comfort to make sure you can run off the bike. But I've always been really comfortable in the TT position. I mean, I'm able to put out more power on a flat road on my time trial bike than I can on my road bike.
What?
And I've been that way my whole life.
That is amazing.
So that's kind of, and I don't know why. I don't know what the logic behind that is. So that's always kind of, it's been in my favor.
You mentioned that you know more about how to put power out over the road on a time trial. Can you describe like what you would do?
Yeah, I mean, I've learned a lot, and a lot of it's not something that necessarily a number will tell you. It's, you might have a goal number, and that's a useful barometer. I mean, I'll tell you a fun fact. I've never time trialed looking at power in my entire professional cycling career. Huh. I might use it in the first 5 minutes of a long TT to make sure I don't go out too hard, and then the screen on the Garmin goes over, and I don't look, because I think that's twofold. I think you can limit yourself. I think it's a valuable tool, but you need to know the limits of your body. And I've had performances where if I'd been looking at that the whole time, I would have backed off because I might have thought I can't do this. And as far as metering the effort out, you know, you use the power kind of where you're moving the most slowly, because the effort required to go from 60K an hour to 62K an hour is massive. Like, to just, and you know, depending on your body type, this is for me, if you're 80 kilos, it's a different story. So for me, it's really, you get up to speed and my position allows me to float a bit and maintain that speed, and then using the power where it benefits the most, which is where the speed's dropping on any kind of uphill drag, over the tops of any rollers, because it's all about speed at the end of the day. It's not about an even power, because if you took two people and they both rode at 350 watts over a given course, or I bet if you looked at an Ironman file between two guys, you could find something where, with similar aerodynamics, one goes significantly faster for the exact same power average output. And that would just be down to how they use it. Because if you're trying to do 350 watts uphill, downhill, flat, everything, it's going to be different than if that's your average, but you did 400 watts up every roller and 300 down. And from my experience, what I've learned, it's about racing the course, not racing the number.
That's how I do it. 400 watts up every roller, 300 down.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
This is cycling. I'm talking about cycling, not Ironman. I don't think I'll be seeing that number.
You mentioned changing like your position on the bike. Is there something that you've, because you were national time trial champion. Were you a junior? Are you 23?
I did win under 23 nationals. Yeah.
So you've been at that game for a while. Compared to other athletes, or perhaps common conceptions of like what a time trial position is like, do you have a different position than what most people do? Do you do anything unique on your bike to set it up?
No, I mean, like I said, at times I've been thankful for everything in pro cycling. We've had great sponsors, we've had great equipment, but you're limited by the UCI position restrictions, which, even though I'm a small guy, it's not advantageous to me. There's more I could do to be more, I mean, I can be a lot more aerodynamic basically, with the freedom to just have the position I'd like. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, you are constrained by just the equipment you have, and maybe you know that there's a better position, but maybe you need to 3D print a certain thing to make sure that your elbows are in the exact perfect position. And those are just, sometimes that's not possible. It's just not practical. There are 30 athletes on every team. It's not a practical application of you know, the team's time, basically. That said, you know, in cycling, that's how I got to my position. I mean, the team has great resources. They helped me arrive to the fastest possible position. But now the goal is to obviously push that forward, moving on to new bikes with Canyon, moving on to the fastest bikes with Canyon, and having the freedom to play around more with that position.
What are some of the UCI requirements that you get to ditch that you're happy about?
The biggest one, you can have one exception. Your saddle can be further than, minus 5 centimeters forward, or you can have a length extension. So like if you're Taylor Finney, you kind of use the length extension and you can't use the saddle further forward, right? And now it doesn't matter. So for me, it's honestly, I always use the saddle one, having it further forward. Mm-hmm. And I can never extend things as far as I wanted.
Okay.
So that'll be the most useful. Is that also the angles of everything? Everything has to be horizontal, parallel to the ground with your forearms. And now, which doesn't really allow you to fully close that front area between your arms and your head, basically. And now, you know, if you look back, it's kind of the positions that were banned. Like Floyd Landis used it in Torf, California. Mm-hmm. Levi Lifeheimer put it to pretty good use. And if you look at those pictures, there's no frontal exposure to the wind.
So if you can fold yourself into a ball, I have problems as things hurt when I do that. Do you have any exercises, or how have you like taught yourself to be able to hold that position?
You know, moving into the sport of Ironman, there definitely are more kind of functional strength exercises that I'll do as you involve running and cycling. I probably never did as much as I should have. The biggest thing, and there's no replacement for it, much like everything, is ride the bike. And don't ride the bike at 200 watts on a flat road and go back and forth and look at yourself in a mirror and say, oh, my head's in a really nice position. Ride at race speed. Go find a loop where you climb and descend, and you do everything. Even if you're not going to do that in the race, it's going to make you better on that time trial bike. I've always had the weird ability to climb in my aero bars. Like, I don't need to come out, really, even on steeper stuff. And I think that just comes from, my favorite loop back home. I has probably 3,000 feet of climbing in it that I go do on the TT bike. It's like a 3-hour ride. So it's go put out the race power, go do those efforts. And then while you're doing it, focus on maintaining your position in a safe manner. I mean, I know people have run into trash cans and things like that
because they're looking
for
down.
For the sake of training with aerodynamics. So be safe while doing it. But, like practice, there's no substitute.
Yeah. The principle of specificity.
Yeah, absolutely. Because your body, it's very easy to look really nice and arrow at 200 watts. It's a different thing to do it even at the, at 300 watts or even 250. Different muscles are being used. Different things will hurt and be tight. So it's important to be familiar with that.
Are you looking forward to any changes in equipment? Not with the bike itself, but helmets, it doesn't change. There aren't any restrictions, I don't think, there with UCI and the helmets that you would change, but maybe kit? I don't know if there is anything like that.
Cycling, there's obviously a lot of time and money invested into skin suits these days. You know, it was like highly publicized, the Tour de France with Sky's new skin suits and all that. And it is a real thing. Like the skin suit aerodynamics, it's pretty wild at high speeds what a difference it can make. You know, coming into triathlon, I'm testing out different things right now. Whoever I partner with on the clothing aspect, the aerodynamics will definitely be a factor, because you multiply things that normally I'm used to looking at over 30 to 50K and you multiply it to 112 miles. I mean, it's, you're quarter of a second per kilometer. All of a sudden, it's actually a little bit of time, something like that. Those things add up over four and a half hours on the bike. So I don't know exactly what I may change yet. I mean, we always had very fast skin suits. We had Castelli for a really long time. Beginning to make sure that I'm very comfortable in the stuff will be important as well.
I like that you're thinking of it, though, because I think some cyclists, especially in the tour, like in Europe, they don't think about those things. It's just all about history, right? And I think there's this new evolution, especially in triathlon, where they really care about the details and they'll do things that buck tradition because it's faster.
Yeah, Team Sky is seen as an outlier from the outside in because of that because of their lead of that attention to detail. And surely, you know, plenty of other teams also do the same, but tradition in the sport of triathlon doesn't usually trump, or, you know, I won't use trump, doesn't usually, you know, replace the advantage that you would get from data.
Yeah, I mean, it's a relatively young sport, right? The Tour de France is over 100 years old.
Yeah.
The Olympics, obviously, very historied and storied. But, you know, this is just over Ironman. The Ironman specifically event is you know, over 30 years old, right? That's a significant difference. And I think it has that in its favor, is that it's not stuck in, it has the beautiful history of it, how it started, the kind of incredible stories of the athletes and the human aspect of it, but it's not stuck in a tradition that doesn't encourage maybe progress. And that can be looked at in many ways on a business model. They're growing it in an incredible way, but also on the athlete model, athletes are encouraged to push to be faster. They're encouraged to innovate because it seems that Ironman as a business, as an organization, embraces that. And you see that filter all the way down from the pros to the age group athletes.
Yeah.
But just a few years ago, no one had sleeves. And then people started to use sleeves because it was faster. And now everyone has sleeves. Mm-hmm. And
it's
people
awesome.
Are even putting on
sleeves.
For the bike because they can think it's going to save me 5 minutes and it takes me 1 minute to put this on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's all a cost benefit. And, you know, there is something to be said. I was, from my personal experience, too, believing that you have the fastest stuff on. So maybe it's a very small difference, but if you mentally, you set off on a 112 mile bike ride and you're like, man, I'm dialed in, I have what I need, that's going to put you in a better mental space to perform than if you think, maybe should I have done this, maybe should I have done that. I mean, the mental side is huge, and people can say it's, you know, I guess that would be actually defined as like a placebo effect of certain things.
Totally.
But it still has an effect.
Yeah.
So
I think that's well researched and proven.
Yeah.
And how bad do you want it? There's a story of research of giving one person extra hydrogenated water and one person regular water. The extra hydrogenated water went faster, but they both got regular water.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yep. No, if you, I mean, I know the power of that. When you think that you've got the best stuff and you line up knowing that, it's a huge mental motivation. You know, that's like what a team like Sky honestly embraces, right?
Yeah.
And it's arguable even sometimes whether, like, do you actually have the best equipment? Is it really the fastest? But if you believe that you do, that will play a role.
I'm going to get meta here right now, but you get to do that now. Because before you didn't get to pick your sponsors, but now you get to interview people, and I'm sure everyone's lining up to work with you. And you get to pick the thing that you really believe in, right? Like,
can you tell us who any of those are? I mean, we know Canyon for the bike.
Yeah, I'm actually having some meetings regarding this week, regarding kind of filling in the rest of that, as far as, you know, wheels, components, everything. And I won't lie, that side's really important to me. And I said with partnering with Canyon, when I came into this, I said, you know what, I'm going to have the absolute best equipment on the face of this planet when I line up, like, period, everything. I don't care if it's a wetsuit, a bike, nutrition. Everything's going to be the best in the world, and then it's down to me. And if I don't deliver on the day or on a certain race, I can finish and say, you know what, that's on me. We need to look at training. I need to look at what I didn't do right. But I'm never going to have a situation in the sport of Ironman or triathlon where I line up and, you know, maybe I'm close to a win or close to a personal best or a result that I'm looking for, and I say, man, if I had just had what Jan Frodeno has or something like that, that's not going to exist. And that reflects itself in who I'm partnering with. And I mean, it's Canyon, they have the best product in the world. That was also known within the World Tour when you were racing. I mean, Tony Martin.
That's
on,
why he went
on
there.
That. Yeah, there's a big appeal there. They are a company that will continue to push to have the best. They're not going to say, well, we just have this and we're the best, so we'll stop now. They're going to continue to push that. I mean, there's a reason they have the guy who's, you know, two-time world champion. We'll see tomorrow if he takes a third, as well as other, you know, a host of other top athletes in road cycling and triathlon. So for me, that's the appeal is, yeah, like you said, I'm building this. You know, it is maybe an individual sport at times when you're out there alone, but you build your own team of people and sponsors. And yeah, I can share, I mean, obviously, not that you can see it, but a hat sitting here.
Yeah.
You know, Cliff Bar is a big supporter of this. There's somebody I wanted to work with for a long time. They always supported me on the product end, and now getting to formally partner with them, they have the best products, so that makes it simple. Their values, the story of the company from Gary Erickson and Kit almost selling it, and I believe it was 2000, to taking a walk around the block and turning down a huge financial gain, something that was known, you know, that's where Gary's ethos of passion comes from, right? The logical thing was sell the company, you make a lot of money, it's a known. And they could have, nobody could have known except or believed, except for maybe Gary and Kit and the people involved, that Clif Bar would become the company it is today. But here it is, and it's the biggest, you know, not at all cycling specific, biggest, you know, kind of nutrition company in the world. I mean, you see it over in stores in Girona, Spain. Spanish guys are always actually coming up to our bus when they were our sponsor and asking for the blocks. They love the blocks. But it expands beyond that. I mean, I have companies like, you know, there are a few other ones, Canyon, Clif Bar. There's companies like Topical Edge, which are smaller. It's, you know, they're kind of getting their footing. And in cycling, we'd always drink this liter of sodium bicarbonate before time trials because it really does buffer lactic acid and has a great effect. It also can possibly wreck your gut, so it's a cost benefit. There are scientific benefits to drinking it every day of a grand tour. I think that was attempted, and after a few days, one of the guys was trying it, was like, I can't do this. My stomach's not gonna survive. Right, gut health is hard enough in 3 weeks. And Topical Edge is it's basically sodium bicarbonate, but they use it's topical, like it sounds like, and kind of has the same effect, if not more so, because it doesn't have to go through kind of the stomach acid and all of that to get in there. But it buffers lactic acid, helps recovery. I have actually used the product. It's pretty cool, and I don't think it'll be that long till it's kind of just a racing and training staple of most athletes, just like you know, maybe Normatec recovery boots, something like that people just, I don't know about this, and then they try it, see it, accept it. One kind of cool one is there's a company, Halo Neuroscience. They make it's headphones, and the headphones are just a byproduct. It's actually what's on the top of them. It's a neurostim company, and basically it's like neuroplasticity is what they're playing with, and it's kind of a cool partnership because obviously I've spent a lot of time on the bike, but things like running and especially swimming are so technique dependent that, and having to go, and I haven't done those sports for over 10 years, so having to go and kind of relearn the proper technique and get that ingrained neurologically is something that they can help a lot with. And there are a few others actually that I'll be kind of running through this week that are fun. Garmin's a great one. Been with them for, you know, since I bought Garmin's when I was younger, right? And then raced for Garmin Cervelo, and I've been with them forever. So they're part of this new journey. And there are a couple others that hope I'll be able to talk about in a few days.
Awesome. So
for the swim, you're going to be coached for that, and that's technique based. Bike, you got it covered. For the run, that can kill a lot of people, is getting injured. How are you going to manage? And you have to run against, I'm guessing you'll be in the front pack on the bike, if not the first off the bike, but then you have to run. There's been a lot of triathletes who are great bikers, and on perfect condition days in the past they could win, but now the best runners are also the best bikers.
It's interesting. I mean, the run is, you know, the swim you can push, you can train a lot, you're not really running the risk of an acute injury. The run, you are 100%. I mean, I got a stress fracture in high school. That said, my body's a lot different now. And I think my greatest risk is having that sort of aerobic engine and body and mentality to push and push and push.
Yeah.
And I'm really going to have to embrace this as that kind of 3-year and beyond project, because I think that will be, but to get to really make that kind of 3-year plan work, a lot of it's avoiding injury. A lot of it's staying healthy. And I think if I overdo it on the running side, I could wreck my chances, not only of 2018, but of just progressing over the next several years. You know, in with the snap of a finger. And again, that goes to the coaching side. And I'm actually firming that up probably a little bit later today. But, you know, who I'll be working with, it's a very, maybe some would say, overly conservative approach to that. The engine's there. It's about bringing along the running ability. I mean, like I said, half Ironmans will push. But, you know, when you're talking about the speeds that are being run that you need to run to be competitive off the bike, it's not a 15-minute 5K. I mean, the mile pace is very different. It's very aerobic for the marathon off the bike. The risk is injury. So it's taking it slowly. It's keeping that long-term goal in mind. And it's kind of, especially in this first year, saving those initial, you know, efforts where maybe I can't walk for a week afterwards, saving those for race day.
Yeah.
Because if I, like I said, I know how to suffer. And as long as the body's primed to have the performance, I think I'll just have to deal with it on race day. But you know, not leave that effort in a 20-mile training run 3 weeks before the race. So I'm gonna have to be more conservative than I would like to, but I think in the long run it'll pay off.
Yeah, I think that we all suffer from that. Whenever I go out to experiment with running, you know, as a person that's constantly riding mountain bikes or road bikes, I usually destroy myself.
Yeah, that aerobic fitness is a blessing and a curse.
It really messes you up.
Your tendons aren't ready.
Yep. Yeah,
no,
exactly. Yeah.
No, right. And they, you know, it's, and you know, in all honesty, my run training, even if I, you know, get towards the top of the sport, it'll probably never look like what somebody like Jan Frodeno's run training looks like, because he's an incredible runner. He's a, you know, his speed, he's been running his whole career. In my run training, I might never be as good of a runner as he is, or a lot of these top guys. And my run training will probably never look like theirs because I don't have that sort of background. Who knows, maybe in the same vein, maybe their training on the bike would never look like mine. I don't know what theirs looks like, but I think it's balancing it all.
What's your daily diet look like?
A lot of food. It's funny you ask that. I mean, with one of my favorite things about moving into this sport is people who've known me and they knew me when I was younger. I grew up swimming, running, surfing, doing things that developed upper body muscle, which doesn't help you in cycling. It's unfortunate to say, but literally it does nothing for you. Aerodynamically, you know, even if you're looking at it, climbing, it absolutely does not help. So my whole career in cycling has been a process of constantly and repeatedly, because you can't do it forever, trying to shed the upper body muscle, then you let it come back a little bit, and then shed it again for a race. And it's not a great thing to do for your body. It's not natural to try to. Losing fat's one thing, losing muscle is another one. It's super hard on your immune system. Mm-hmm. It's super hard on your, you know, hormonal system. And now it's no longer about just being this kind of light person who can climb, because I was always strong at a time trial, and then it was translating it to climbing. It wasn't trying to improve my time trial for climbing, where, you know, an Ironman, obviously you're going to be lean and fit, but you have to be resilient and strong. And at the end of the day, back to the diet part, now, you know, I've always had my best results when you just fuel properly. You eat a lot, but when you eat healthy, you can basically eat as much as you're capable of when you're training 4 to 7 hours a day, and your body needs all of that fuel. I mean, cycling, I don't know the world of Ironman well enough to speak to it. The world of cycling has a lot of, you know, stigma around eat this on a rest day, do this. And my best results training, racing, have always just been balanced. And I recommend that to everybody. And anything extreme is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. And consistency is the key. So if you have something that's consistent, that works for you, and also that keeps you healthy, then that's the ticket. I don't know if you want more specifics.
I do. Okay. So you mentioned eating healthy. What is like eating healthy for you? Like what kind of food? And I'd like to know like what you kind of eat on a regular basis, and then also like the night before big race morning, when you're on the tour and you have to feed for 3 weeks. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a creature of habit. If I'm training properly, I like things that are familiar and easy. I'll have oatmeal with some almond butter and coconut oil and granola and maple syrup, basically. And it's very repeatable, right? Because if you're traveling, you can have some instant oats. You can have it almost anywhere. Some toast and some eggs, and that varies a little. Sometimes, you know, if it's a lighter day, maybe just toast and eggs, maybe no eggs, whatever, a variation. The oatmeal is a staple when I'm into a proper training block, and that's actually part of the appeal of it, is like when I'm racing at the tour, that's breakfast every single day, you know. Yeah. For a month straight, right? And then I don't eat oatmeal for like a month after that, or a while. You know, you see guys having pasta for breakfast, whatever works for them. Sometimes I'll throw some rice in there with the eggs every now and then. More racing than training. I don't like doing that in training. I don't really like eating tons of pasta and rice for breakfast. Lunch will be, I mean, a lot of times you're kind of training through lunch. I mean, that'll be a different dynamic within Ironman. About, you know, you have two sports or maybe three sports in the day that you're doing, so you kind of have time to refuel. On the bike, a lot of times you miss lunch, you get back, eat something simple. I like smoothies if it's hot out. honestly, simple stuff. I mean, maybe some, it sounds boring, but some, a sandwich, some chicken and pasta, like any of those can be depending on what ride was done. And then dinner, it's pretty simple. You know, I'll tell you, before a race, I get very simple. I would do the same thing before any Ironman event that I'll take on. Some rice, some chicken or fish, and maybe a little salad, and like that's it. It's simple, it doesn't upset your stomach, it processes quickly. Mm-hmm. So during the Tour de France, like, you almost dumb down your diet a bit, right? You're maybe not as intricate. During the tour, we have on, I think, the best chef in the entire Peloton, Sean Fowler, and his wife Olga. Yeah. And they drive around in a little van and cook for us at every race in France and every Grand Tour. So the Tour de France, Paris-Nice, Dauphiné, you have incredible food. You're not wanting for anything. Mm-hmm. They prepare the recovery meals. So with, you know, but I'm a pretty simple person. I mean, I'll go out to, even with friend, not some friends who are maybe masters bike racers or something, and sometimes we'll go to dinner and I order a burger and fries and you have a beer, and they're like, you can eat that right now? And I'm like, yeah, because it's food. You have to, food is about enjoying your meal, talking with other people, and there's actually like a huge amount of kind of science now behind that. A huge aspect of recovery is that social aspect. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what meals are, right? Like, you sit down with your family and you enjoy dinner, you sit down with your friends. It's not just a matter of fueling the machine. At the Tour de France, definitely, I will tell you, in a Grand Tour turns into that, and it's not that much fun sometimes. Mm-hmm. You're eating out of necessity. But, you know, that's what I've known so far. Going in Ironman, the nutritional challenges and requirements are honestly completely different than anything I've faced. So it'll be a learning process.
I was just going to bring up, I know a lot of triathletes just get their carbohydrates through a drink, right? And that's, and a lot of that has to do, I'm sure, with the running and the jarring that comes thereafter instead of eating a solid food. Is that anything you've experimented with, or is that something that you're looking forward to try? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I'll absolutely test out in training, and even to the extent of like fully, I mean, I think there's obviously a ton of value to running through, you know, exactly what you will do on race day and making sure that sits well. Because it's one thing, I mean, I can consume an incredible amount of calories on the bike and have zero stomach issues, but having to get off your bike and then run a marathon, I mean, it could ruin your race if you don't get it right. So it's something that obviously with Cliff I'll be working with to figure out the best nutritional strategy, learning, you know, what's worked for other athletes, trying different things out in training before I line up. And I have no doubt that there'll probably be an event or two where, you know, it does not go to plan. So that's just kind of goes with the territory.
Yeah.
When you did have to lose weight, what would you do? If you, let's say you need to lose a kilo or two, what would you do?
You know, it's a funny, for me, it was always a funny thing. Whenever I lose weight, like it would, there was effort, but there was also like this natural side of it. And it always corresponded to when you were flying. Like, your body has these rhythms, and certain times, like before Tour of California this year, things finally clicked in training, your power is going up, and you're just kind of leaning out, and it's not requiring a ton of effort. I think part of it is during those times you're training so much, you're riding 4 to 7 hours a day, and numeric, like, it's gonna kind of wither you away, right, naturally. What's harder is, you know, I mean, for me, it's the basics. You kind of just cut out any alcohols, any, you know, wine or beer, things like that. Cut out some of the sweets. I love pastries for breakfast. It's one of my favorite. I love scones. You know, everywhere I go, I have to try a scone. Yeah. So, or as Australians, apparently it's scone. I was talking to our Australian teammate, Brendan Canty, at Tour of California. I was like, oh, we should go. Are there any scones? We're at a coffee shop. And he's like, what? What's a scone? What are you talking about?
Scone.
Scone. I was like, all right.
They have a nickname or a different name for everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's the right one. I don't know.
Do you ever get that far from race weight, though?
Only in the off season. I'd race at like 138, 139. In the off season, maybe 144, 145. Oh, yeah. But, you know, that's when you haven't ridden your bike for a month and everything. And then I never had huge fluctuations, but again, in pro cycling, it was this weird thing where, I mean, a pound, 2 pounds, like you really noticed that up a mountain, and you had to be conscious of it. And I mean, you hear guys like Chris Froome talk about it. It's a reality. There's no getting around, you know, it's free. If you can maintain the power and weigh less, it's free. You know, where an Ironman, I think it's quite a bit more about power.
Yeah. So a way to say it back to you is, it sounds like you feel your workouts more. And then once you're fueling properly and really have it dialed, the weight comes off.
Exactly. And I think the key with that is, you know, the place to ever cut anything out, I don't think it's ever during, well, at least, you know, the bike. I mean, I can only speak from the bike. You don't want to underfuel, because the moment you do that, your immune system takes a tremendous hit. So it's important to fuel your efforts. And, you know, maybe if you're going out for a 5-hour easier ride, it's different. But it's science. Whenever you're doing high intensity, it runs off glycogen. If you don't have glycogen, bad things start happening in the body. From my personal experience, different people might be able to handle different things. It's never worked well for me.
You mentioned you can eat a lot and your stomach doesn't mess up. Do you know how many calories an hour you might eat?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, cycling is also interesting in that sometimes it's Ironman, you have maybe more control over how often you do. And in the Tour, sometimes the first hour is insane and you're just drinking, right, and trying to put a few gels in. And then maybe if there's a lull, you'll eat in a 30-minute period, like as much as you can handle almost, because you know the body kind of needs it later. And it's not ideal, but it tends to work. You know, in bike racing, you fuel as it allows. I mean, some people mention, but in bike racing, you have these cruisy times. And I could show them some files from the Tour de France this year. There are no cruisy times there. And, you know, even if you're cruisy, you can't take your hands off the handlebars because it's raining and you're going 60K an hour centimeters from other people. So there's a lot going on. I mean, and absolutely, sometimes in bike racing, you see it. Peloton sits up on a flat day and you're like, okay, and you can eat. It's a buffet on a bike. It's fine. But equally, that's not the norm.
Right. How do you make it work in those situations, though, where you're just afraid to take your hands off the bars?
You just have to, basically. I mean, you find a moment, you revert to basically gels, to liquid calories, to drinking your calories there. You know, your guts sometimes feel that later, for sure.
Yeah.
But it's all a balance. You just kind of, everybody has what works for them too, right? I mean, some guys will start with like very calorie dense drinks. Some guys start with, you know, just electrolytes. Some guys literally just want water. I mean, it's across the whole spectrum in cycling. With Ironman, I know the nutritional part is a huge factor, because you can't just take in calories on the swim or on the run. So that'll be a whole new challenge to manage.
Yeah. It's going to be really interesting.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, so am I. Wow.
I think it's almost like the Cliff Bar story, too, where you had a known thing in cycling, and you said,
exactly,
you know what,
that.
I'm going to try this unknown thing because it's better for my family and my life and my longevity. So, like, and it's exciting for
us to
watch.
And it aligns to your passion.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
It's so cool.
I appreciate that. I mean, that's the word you use. That's what I want people to associate with this kind of journey or adventure we're taking on. Because it truly is, it's an adventure and it's a challenge and it's entering into the unknown and it's fueled 100% by passion. There is no logic in, you know, maybe there was, in my mind, there was some, but from the outside, there's not really a lot of logic in leaving maybe this known quantity that you're good at. That's, you know, I don't think any pro sport's stable, but maybe a bit more stable for something that you don't even, you know, I haven't competed in a triathlon yet.
Yeah.
It's a total unknown.
Totally.
But again, that's what kind of fuels my passion and drives me. And definitely I draw inspiration from Gary Erickson was one of the first people I spoke to about this. On the phone quite a few months ago. And, you know, if he had said, Andrew, this is insane, stick to what you're doing, then we might not be having this conversation. But he said, I think this is a fantastic idea. You should go after it. You know,
that's
like
cool.
Create your own story, live your passion and really write your own story rather than just going with what's expected. And
that's awesome.
That's what I'm doing.
Almost every great person or people that start companies have a story like that. Right.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
They had something good.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of bad ones too have the same story, but different outcomes.
So. I'm sure you're going to have plenty of training days up in Tahoe coming up.
Absolutely.
When you do, we should set up times to check in, because obviously we're right down there in Reno.
Yeah.
We're super close. We should set up times to check in and see how your training is going and see how things have changed or see. You know, I think that'll be really interesting.
It would be great. I mean, before it cooled off too much, it was cold that day, but I did a swim across Donner Lake. Like, I think it's around 2.7 miles just to make sure I'd swam. I was like, okay, I haven't swam in open water, at least, you know, the 2.4 miles straight. So I'll go give it a go. I had a friend on a paddleboard with me. Obviously I had a wetsuit on, but I was like, it was cool. He recorded the time. He's got it somewhere. I was like, I just want to go.
Yeah.
So stuff like that. I mean, go revisit that for sure in the spring and the summer as I build up. And Yeah, I'd love to check in.
I'm rooting for you. I think this is something that's super exciting, and hopefully we can kind of create amongst the Trainer Road users that are listening to this and other people that aren't Trainer Road users that are listening to this, get them excited on this too and get them cheering for you. I think
really
this is going to be awesome.
Really exciting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what you said. At the end of the day, I think I'm of the belief that kind of pro sport, it's a bit of a novelty sometimes, right? I mean, there's 2,450, I think, people here, and there's only 100 pros maybe between the men and women. So that's what sport's about. It's kind of, it just gives you this platform to ideally inspire somebody or to create something positive in their lives or to motivate them to draw inspiration from you. And that filters down, you know, one aspect we didn't touch is to working with some different charities and charitable organizations that are close to me, and whether it's getting kids out on bikes, whether it's, you know, helping people who don't have access to beautiful places like where we're sitting right now, and or who think maybe that you know they can't run or swim or ride, or that they can't do that. It's, I think sport is this incredible platform to help people find their own identity sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you know, at the end of the day, it's a platform to do something good with. So beyond whatever results might come, beyond success or failure, anything in between, I hope that this story can grab some people and inspire them to go after their own goals and dreams.
That's awesome. That's a good place to stop.
A great place.
Perfect. Andrew, thank you. Good luck. We'll check in with you as things go on. This is going to be exciting stuff. And if you have any questions for Andrew, or if you just want to send him a note or anything else like that, you can do so at trainerroad.com/podcast. Just drop us a line there, and we'll talk to you all next time. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. Bye-bye. For having me.